Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back to the program Dr. Gerald Mast, who is professor of political science at Carthage, chair of the political science department, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And someone who has been a contributor on frequent occasions to the morning show and to Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're going to be talking with him about something that, in some respects, kind of gets left out of the headlines in this election year, namely the upcoming presidential election, which we presume will pit incumbent President Donald Trump against the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. Neither of those possibilities or probabilities are in fact at this point officially set in stone, but of course, in all likelihood, that will be the two major choices voters will face come November. And of course, with so many other things going on in our country and in our world right now, in some respects, conversations about this current presidential race have been shunted a bit off to the side. We're going to do something about that today and talk about the prospect of Trump versus Biden and how these two are doing in the polls, as far as we know at this point, and some of the factors that are contributing to whatever the current state of affairs is between the two of them politically. And I can't think of anybody better than Jerry Mast to offer analysis and commentary on that. Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, I can't think of a forum I'd rather be sharing my thoughts on than your show, Greg. So good to be back.
I appreciate that. So, Biden versus Trump, Trump versus Biden. We assume that those will be the two names at the top of the ticket on people's ballots come November. It seems kind of strange to even frame that as a likelihood rather than a certainty, but in fact, neither of the political conventions has yet occurred. Right. Is there any even remote possibility that it won't be Trump versus Biden in terms of the Republicans and Democrats in November?
I really doubt it. I mean, I think that, in fact, we are looking at the candidates. You know, the Republican Party started canceling their primaries well in advance of the primaries, right? Because there was really little in the way of substantive opposition to Mr. Trump within the party. And so, in a way, they didn't even really hold much of a primary contest at all. And so the convention on the Republican side really is or was all along going to be the kind of coronation event that modern conventions have evolved into being. I think on the Democratic side, in a way, the emergence of the coronavirus pandemic and the recession that has been triggered in its wake have kind of pulled some of the air out of the room on the Democratic side when it comes to, well, who really should be the nominee, right? One of the challenges of a contested nomination fight is that you wind up with a lot of sore feelings in the room, so to speak. The party has some disputes that it has to kind of get over, and in some sense the convention can function as a way to try to build bridges inside the party and bring the party together. And, you know, I would say that for the large stretch of the Democratic primary, in which there was a really large field, and there was a really, kind of, I think, pretty broad ideological range amongst the contestants, it seemed like the convention was really going to be necessary to kind of patch up, you know, some of the sore feelings that emerged over the course of the primary contests themselves. But I would say that the relatively quick way with which Mr. Biden managed to build a pretty insurmountable delegate lead in the wake of Super Tuesday, followed by the coronavirus emergence and the economic recession, have really kind of meant that, you know, I think Democrats are ready to rally behind Biden and move forward. And so from, you know, a Milwaukeean's perspective, it's disappointing to see the convention not going to function in this really important way that you can normally would expect it to. You know, the fact that it's been kind of downgraded in terms of the size and intensity with which a convention typically is carried out. They're going to do a lot of remote kinds of activities. They're discouraging a lot of people to come in person to the conventions. It's not clear exactly how it will play out, but it does seem like it will be a scaled down affair. So it's disappointing for Milwaukee. It's disappointing for Wisconsin, I think, in that regard. But I think that the Democratic Party can breathe a sigh of relief that it kind of seems like the party is ready to just move forward in this regard.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Mast from the political science faculty at Carthage College. And we are talking about this current presidential race that, as we were saying in the introduction, has to some extent been a bit shunted off to the side by really huge pressing concerns, such as the COVID-19 crisis and this very serious recession that we find ourselves in, and of course, widespread demonstrations across the country around Black Lives Matter. So let's talk some numbers. It is early, of course, it's still June, but at this point in time, what do the polls tell us in terms of how Joe Biden and President Trump are doing with American voters? And at this moment, what does it look like? What might ensue in this election?
Yeah, well, conventionally speaking, it's hard to knock off a one-term president seeking re-election when his party has been out of power up until that first term, which is the case, right? So President Obama was a two-term president. The Democrats had the White House for 8 years. Republicans won the White House in 2016. In that kind of situation, right, it's really hard to beat an incumbent. And so you would expect the incumbent to be in pretty good shape in the polls. And in fact, that's not the case. So if we look at there's a couple of organizations that aggregate all the polls, all the reputable polls, to create an average of the polls. I tend to rely on the website Real Clear Politics for that. 538 is another good statistically sound website that aggregates polls for averages. And both of those sites have Mr. Biden ahead of Mr. Trump at around 10%, 9 to 10% of all the polls averaged. That's a really big lead for a challenger at, you know, 4 months out from the election. And so, you know, I would also point out that lead has grown. It's almost doubled in the last 4 weeks. So if we go back to late May, that lead was kind of consistently hovering in the 5% range. But since May, that lead has just diverged. The support has grown for Mr. Biden. It's declined down to around 40% for Mr. Trump. And unless Mr. Trump reverses these trends and changes the not just the trends, but closes the gap in the months ahead, I mean, we're really looking at potentially a landslide election for Mr. Biden.
It's interesting because I think when you say the words Joe Biden has a 10% lead, in some respects, just at a glance, that doesn't seem like a huge lead numerically. And yet you're pointing out that, first of all, historically, for a challenger to an incumbent, having that kind of lead is very, very substantial. And I suppose beyond that, where that lead is or how it is distributed amongst the whole population, that also matters a lot in terms of if that lead translates into the electoral votes that one needs to in fact be elected.
Absolutely, right. So the Electoral College will be the mechanism by which the winner is determined. But when you dive down into the numbers in the key states there, again, there's some real troubling signs for President Trump. So according to the Real Clear Politics average of polls, Mr. Biden has a 6 percentage point lead in Wisconsin, almost a 9 percentage point lead in Michigan, and a 6 point lead in Pennsylvania. Those are the three key states that put Mr. Trump in the White House in 2016. But the bad news isn't really limited there. So if you go to Florida, for instance, the Real Clear Politics averages Mr. Biden plus about 7%, 7% lead there on average. In Arizona, a state that has reliably been a Republican state for the presidential level, Mr. Biden's up by 4. In North Carolina, a similar state to Arizona, one of those red states that is starting to become contestable, Biden is up by a couple percentage points. It's essentially tied in Ohio and in Texas. This is a kind of a surprise. Mr. Trump has a 1% lead in the Real Clear Politics average, and the 538 average, I think, has it tied. In most of these states, the 538 averages are a little bit higher, a percentage point or two for Mr. Biden. So there's not a lot of really, you know, encouraging data right now for Mr. Trump. And he's in a position where I think he and his campaign have to be arriving at the conclusion that what they're currently doing is not enough. They're going to have to think about deviations from the way in which they're doing things. Or they're going to have to hope for changes in the larger environment that will work to their advantage.
What can you tell us about the numbers in deeply, firmly red states that have been very solidly for President Trump? Do we see much in the way of deterioration there? Not that necessarily Mr. Biden is likely to carry any of those states, so it's maybe just for a matter of interest more than anything, but are we seeing those numbers come down, or is his support in his most sort of solid states remaining very loyally behind him?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, we'll have to wait till we're closer to the election date or even afterwards to kind of get a sense of how that happens. There's not a lot of polling in a lot of those states.
They're just not done?
Yeah, right. So pollsters are concentrating their resources in those states where, there's an interesting story to find. And that doesn't mean that there aren't interesting stories in those other states. It's just that, we're not going to be able to anticipate all the interesting stories that emerge. And so,
wow. So nobody is polling the voters in Mississippi, for instance.
Yeah, I haven't seen any polls out of Mississippi. A couple polls come out of Georgia, though, and that state looks competitive, which suggests to us that these states that haven't gotten a lot of polling, maybe it's time to rethink that.
Interesting. So, and I suppose the other thing to remember is that even if there are certain states that remain massively supportive of President Trump, in a sense, it doesn't matter how massive that support is or how big those leads are in these particular states. They still have only a particular number of electoral votes that can go to President Trump. And in order to win this election, there must be, at least to some extent, widespread support in a number of states, in enough states to give you those electoral numbers. And
right. That's
where it does not look good at the moment.
Right. And I guess one thing that I think is important to try to understand how the electorate's going to decide matters in November is who the electorate is going to be. And the electorate is always changing over time. And so, there's some important generational shifts and changes. The older generations slowly pass away. And so their size, their share of the overall electorate gets smaller and smaller. Young people come into the electorate. And so their share of the electorate gets larger and larger. And so if you look at the silent generation and older, the greatest generation, in 2016, they were 13% of the electorate. And that's a group that is pretty reliably Republican, conservative. Projections this year is that they'll be around 9%. So that's a 4% decline. And Gen Z, the youngest folks who are voters, were 4% of the election, or the electorate in 2016. And they're projected to be 10% of the electorate. And so you have a 6% gain at the bottom, a 4% loss at the top, and the electorate all of a sudden is a lot more liberal than you might expect, because younger people are more frequently embracing liberal policy positions and identifying with Democrats.
So given these numbers that, at least for the moment, and we should reiterate, of course, that it's, in some ways, it's still early. In some ways, it's very late. It's kind of depends on maybe if you're Mr. Biden or Mr. Trump, if it's early in the game or late in the game. But at any rate, at this point in time, the numbers should be alarming for President Trump and for his supporters. Are any of
on
these
that point? I mean, I just want to like reinforce the importance of what you just said. I mean, if the last 3 months or last 4 months haven't taught you the dangers of trying to predict what's likely to happen in the world, I don't know what would, right? I mean, if we just look back on the last 4 months and don't conclude that it's hard to predict what will happen in the next 4 months, I mean, you're not paying attention.
Exactly. So yeah, a lot can happen between now and November. And of course, what might happen between now and November might be helpful to President Trump or might hurt him still further. In terms of these dismal numbers regarding President Trump, do these polls point to particular reasons for that, or to determine that, do we have to kind of look elsewhere or come to those understandings in other ways?
Yeah, I think that in the last 3 months or so, the shift towards Mr. Biden, especially in the last 4 months, the last 4 weeks, the last month or so, the shift towards Mr. Biden is quite likely driven by a pretty large disapproval of the way in which President Trump has handled the issue of racial injustice, the social unrest that's emerging in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by police officers in Minneapolis, and Breonna Taylor in Louisville, and Ahmaud Arbery down in Georgia. Sadly, it's not a short list of unarmed Black Americans who have died at the hands of law enforcement. And so I think that if you look at the numbers, Mr. Trump is really got his work cut out for him to build a convincing case that, one, he understands this problem and has a compelling vision for what should be done about it. And so, just for instance, these are numbers that come out of the most recent Pew Center research that came out in the last week. And this is American perceptions of Trump's effects on race relations in the United States. And the Pew researchers broke down responses into three, as three possible responses. You could say that Trump has made them better. You could say that he tried to improve them but failed, or you could say that he's made them worse. And the plurality of responses are that he has made things worse. It's essentially almost half of the entire adult population thinks he's made them worse. This is important on a number of levels. He's losing independence on this. So that the people in the middle, for whom, you know, every presidential race is, you know, determined by, they're skeptical and critical of his performance there. And then I guess I would say that his handling of the coronavirus is also getting very poor marks overall, although high marks and steady marks from Republicans. And so the shift in President Trump's approval numbers for how he handled the coronavirus, this is from the website 538. Back in early April, Americans were roughly splitting evenly on approval or disapproval of Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Since early April, those numbers have diverged to the point where now he's down 15 percentage points. That shift has been entirely within independents and Democrats, who have shifted from the think he's doing a good job on coronavirus into the think he's handling it poorly category. And so, these two issues are challenges to the country that the country is judging the president's performance on. And I think that that is why we see this big gap. The one area where I think Mr. Trump, has done pretty well on with respect to how Americans perceive his job performance is the economy. He's gotten relatively high marks there over the course of his first 3.5 years. But since, you know, the financial collapse in March and April, and the historically large shift of unemployment to the point of where we're, you know, around 15% unemployment, I think that's really eaten into the one issue where he, could, plausibly make a decent case for reelection.
If you were in a position to advise him, I'm just curious what you would have him do when it comes to some of these big matters and trying to, in a sense, undo damage that has already been done in terms of his support around, for instance, the pandemic or the social unrest that we're seeing right now. What kinds of things do you think would make a difference to that portion of the electorate that is tilting away from him over those issues?
It's a good question. It's hard. It's really difficult. So most presidents see themselves as an American president who is elected into the White House. And in the wake of a, difficult election, they begin to the process of rhetorically shifting to the center, trying to reach out to winnable, persuadable voters and members of Congress who are moderate on the other side of the aisle, and try to govern, from a position of working through these challenges or these differences of opinion, so that they are, in a sense, the chief of state. They're the everybody's president. Now, in order to do that, every president has to balance difficult kind of challenges. This is what Thomas Cronin calls one of the paradoxes of the presidency. Not only do you have to be the country's president, you also have to be the head of your party. And so when you're reaching out to the middle, when you're reaching out to moderates on the other side, The benefit of that from a political standpoint is that you begin to grow the tent a little bit by pulling in some people from the center, but you risk alienating people in your own party, right? And so every president is kind of forced to engage in that kind of political calculus, how far to go. Since he came into office, President Trump he decided to adhere to his own set of rules and kind of be mindless of a number of kind of conventional norms of the office. And he has really just tried to be a Republican president and has made very little effort to reach out to independents or Democrats. And as a result, he is wildly popular in his own party. More popular with his own party than I'd say just about any politician has been in his own party in modern times.
So in other words, President Trump is more popular among Republicans than, for instance, President Obama was with Democrats?
Correct. That's what I'm arguing. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers to verify that, but that's my sense of things. The challenge for Mr. Trump, however, is that for 3.5 years, he's been essentially speaking to his base. And so now he's in a position where he's got to try to break out of that and appeal to different groups of people. And so the advice that, you know, I would give him if I were trying to help him shore up his electoral prospects would be to try to moderate some of the things that he says. To take seriously the inequality of treatment that African Americans receive in the criminal justice system. There's some things that call out for reform in that regard. If you look down at the public polling numbers on the economy, you see pretty high numbers of support amongst Americans for another stimulus. Another big kind of package to come out to help people with respect to helping businesses with grants or with low or no interest loans to keep their payrolls intact, with kind of moratoriums on evictions and mortgage foreclosures. Extension of unemployment benefits. These things are pretty popular. They're more popular with Democrats and they're more popular with independents. But even amongst Republicans, you get a sizable chunk of Republicans who believe that those measures are justified. And right now, it seems like the Congress is not going to do that, right? So we've gotten the one kind of stimulus policy package through, but Republicans in the Senate seem much less interested in doing anything sizable at this point. And so I guess one of the things that I would recommend to President Trump if I were brought on board as a campaign advisor is what he ought to do is roll up his sleeves and bring in Mitch McConnell and his colleagues on the Republican side of the Senate and pressure them to get to work and pass some kind of stimulus package that would help people who are unemployed, businesses that are struggling with their bottom lines, and so forth. Hmm.
It seems to me that one challenge that President Trump faces is that if he were to shift course from the way he has framed just about every issue in very partisan fashion, I mean, very much speaking to his base, who are, after all, the ones who primarily got him elected president. I mean, so his devotion to them is understandable, but if he were to shift in his rhetoric and in a sense become more conciliatory, reaching across the aisle in ways that he has really not done thus far as president, as far as I can tell, it seems to me that puts him in a different kind of precarious situation in terms of what that would mean to his own base, who probably, as much as anything, prize him for his willingness to break the rules and to stand his ground and to not soften his rhetoric.
Right, and he's perceived as a fighter. He's fighting for them. Right.
Yes. And so how does he, in a sense, pull away from that if he must reach out to the independents and those undecided voters that at this moment he seems to have largely lost. How does he get them back without, in a sense, displeasing his base? Or is it impossible for him to displease his base?
That's the conundrum he's in, and it's hard. I don't think it's true that he can't upset his base. However, I think he's built up a lot of capital there. And so if I were really, advising his campaign, I'd say use that capital you've built up with your own base and try your best to convince them that another stimulus package is in the interests of the country and in the interests of his reelection. And I guess I would encourage him to begin the process of more consistent messaging on the coronavirus pandemic. If you look at the ways in which different countries have experienced the pandemic and responded to the pandemic, I mean, it's still a very complicated situation. We're still learning more and more about the virus itself and about the efficacy or lack of efficacy of different kinds of public responses to it. However, at this point, it seems that there are some pretty clear differences in terms of outcomes by country. And the United States is one of the worst countries in terms of outcomes in this regard. I think that there's a number of reasons for that. When you start testing is super important. Testing to identify positive cases of the virus so that you can isolate them and engage in contact tracing and get those people who have been exposed to the person with the disease to go into some kind of quarantine. It seems that how quickly you start that is a really big difference down the road in terms of where the rate of infection goes and the number of cases you end up with having. And so the United States was pretty slow in responding in that regard. We wasted some precious weeks. So that's kind of, in some sense, water under the bridge. But now we're in a case where we're pushing for reopening the economy in places in the South and the West in particular. We're seeing surges in increased number of infectious cases, all of which is fairly concerning. So I mean, I think that what's called for at this point is consistent messaging from government, from leadership. Masks seem to be effective at slowing down the spread of infection. So mask use has sadly become this kind of political issue. It really shouldn't be. And I would argue it's incumbent on Mr. Trump, whether it helps his reelection or not, to speak truthfully about the importance of mask wearing and increasing the amount of testing and contact tracing and maybe revisit some of these, relaxation of social distance protocols, right? Like the opening of bars and restaurants seems questionable. Large parties seem to be an important vector. We just got to be better at kind of consistently messaging what needs to happen as best we can tell based on evidence.
Between President Trump and his challenger Joe Biden, in terms of waging a campaign during the time of COVID, when large gatherings are by and large extremely risky, are they equally hurt, or is one candidate above the other more seriously hurt by this being an environment in which those large gatherings either will not happen or cannot happen with the same frequency or this in the same way that they have in the past?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Although, I mean, a couple things suggest themselves to me. One is that there have been some early attempts to try to trace where increased cases are coming from. And so some of the work that I've heard from public health departments on the West Coast suggests that they're not seeing a spike in infections stemming from racial injustice protests, of which there are large numbers of people congregating together in relatively close proximity. And their conclusions at this point is that, you know, at these protests, large percentage of the people there are wearing masks. Mask wearing does seem to be widely embraced at these protests. Conversely, parties by young people are being identified as kind of hotspots for the passage of the virus, and people aren't wearing masks at those. And so, you know, I think that you can hold campaign events probably reasonably safely if you encourage everybody and get everybody, require everybody even to wear a mask. So at some point, I think that the campaigns can expect some semblance of normalcy in that regard, but mask usage strikes me as a non-negotiable element of it. And when we look at the different perceptions based on party when it comes to mask wearing, again, this is where, I mean, people of color are more likely to support wearing masks or to say they wear masks when they go out. Women are more likely to wear masks or say that people should wear masks than men are when going into public and interacting with people. And it's really white men who are the least likely to say so, and especially Republican white men. And so, you know, when it comes to how the two campaigns are going to handle interacting with supporters and potential supporters, when I think that you know, the two candidates are different in this regard. Joe Biden wears a mask when he's in public, probably because it's sound public health advice, but in some sense he's also using it as a kind of symbol to say, hey, I'm responsible in this regard. And President Trump has kind of obstinately refused to do so. All things are complicated, I guess. But that's the kind of the thing that comes to my mind in response to your question. Do the campaigns equally face a difficult task in this regard?
We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Mast from the Political Science Faculty at Carthage College, of which he is the chair. Professor Mast, in the closing minutes, I want to focus very specifically on the matter of the demonstrations across the country in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in the Twin Cities. I want to give you a chance to, I'm afraid for not a whole long time, but for a few minutes, expand on something I read of yours, in which you talked about how that really tragic killing was, it is, I think you said something to the effect that it is oversimplification to call that a matter of racism or a tragedy that emerged out of simple racism, let's say. But there was actually something else going on that has not been sufficiently discussed when it comes to these kind of incidents of unjust violence that emerge from law enforcement personnel. I want to give you a chance to just expand on that.
Well, yes. So I think that what we absolutely have to do as a society is examine the way in which we perceive force and violence as a kind of appropriate way to deal with conflict in society at large, but also in the process of law enforcement itself. And so law enforcement officers find themselves engaged in conflict on a regular basis. That's part of the job. And you can view your proper approach to a kind of conflictual situation as to try to diffuse or de-escalate a heated situation, or you can view the proper course of action to use overwhelming force to suppress that conflict and snuff it right out. And it seems to me that there is in some to some degree, and I'm not an expert on policing policy or criminal justice issues. I know a fair amount about them, but it's not my area of expertise. But to the extent that I do know a fair bit about the issue, it seems to me that there is a kind of militancy at work in police departments. And you can see that in its most obvious manifestation in the form of actual military equipment, SWAT teams and riot police in full battle gear. But I think you also see it in the interaction between law enforcement officers and certain civilians who are suspected of wrongdoing. And so that interaction, that heated kind of use of force, can make things worse. Instead of de-escalating a situation, it can escalate. And I think that that's part of a kind of cultural perception about what role force should play in trying to get through disagreement or conflict.
It does seem like a very serious conversation is beginning to emerge around this. I mean, maybe more serious than we have seen up to now. I wonder if you are surprised by the what seems to be by no means a unanimous support, but what appears to me to be rising support for the whole notion of Black Lives Matter. I know that within my own life, within my own circle of friends, people who 5 years ago would have been very uncomfortable with that notion, who would have pushed back with, no, all lives matter. I have seen many of them, if not all of them, shift to a position of understanding and support. I wonder if you've seen that as well, and I don't know if there are polls that support that in any kind of tangible way, but is that your sense as well, that we are in a different place than we were?
Absolutely. So numbers have definitely shifted in the last 4 years towards support for Black Lives Matter as a movement. And the Pew Research Center, again, in the last week or so, has released a report on this. 2/3 of all adult Americans express either strong support for Black Lives Matter movement or somewhat support. 2/3. So, I mean, that's really impressive. Amongst whites, it drops to 61%. For blacks, it's 85%. Hispanics, it's 77%. For Asians, it's 75%. The only kind of significant difference we see between groups is parties. So there is a partisan difference here still. So for Republicans, it's 40% support. And for Democrats, it's 90%. Partisanship really functions as this really huge divide between Americans on a number of kind of key pressing issues of the day. That divide between Democrats and Republicans aside, most Americans are definitely moving in the direction of support for Black Lives Matter, which I think kind of I would, you know, call attention to the Republicans' attention to this fact and say, look, you really do need to reexamine your position on some of these key issues.
Right. Well, and with the state legislature in Mississippi, the day before we are recording this, voting to change their flag potentially speaks to some reconsideration of some of this. In our last couple minutes, I want to give you a chance to briefly reflect on a point made in my morning show guest yesterday, Steve Bannon from The Rachel Maddow Show, and his book, The Imposters, which takes Republicans to task for largely abdicating some of the standard function of a major political party when it comes to crafting policy in favor of simply holding on to power. I think you're not surprised that the Republicans find themselves in this situation right now. Any quick comment about that?
Well, I mean, the conservative movement of the last 40 years has pushed a kind of rhetorical viewpoint that says, you know, government's not capable of doing anything, that government is incompetent, and you know, we're here to help is the last thing you want to hear a bureaucrat say, is a quip that Reagan famously used to positive political effect. When you have a party whose position is that government can't do anything very well, and their viewpoint of economic problems and so forth is to cut the cut regulations, to remove regulations, and to cut taxes. That's kind of the tool in their toolbox. And cutting taxes and cutting regulations makes some sense in certain kinds of circumstances. It's situationally, I think, a very justifiable approach. But it's certainly not justifiable as a wholesale view of governing. And since 2010, in particular, with the rise of the Tea Party, the Republican Party has shifted in a very dramatic rightward direction, and has been kind of captured by its base in this regard. Many members of the Congress in the House on the Republican side are not worried about their general elections. Their general elections are largely foregone. They're worried about primary elections. And so the electoral incentives for many of these members of Congress encourage them to essentially just be obstructionists. I think the country as a whole, when you look at the state of infrastructure, the state of healthcare, level of inequality, air quality and water quality in certain areas, I mean, there's a lot of problems that we need to fix. Immigration is a controversial issue, and there's, ways in which we can address some of the problems that exist there. So the country, in my opinion, is really calling out for governance, and it's largely not getting it, largely because one of the two major parties is kind of committed to not really govern.
One of the points that Steve Bannon made in his book is that the Democratic Party also suffers, that the Democratic Party is healthier if the Republican Party is functioning normally. And he really calls on the Republican Party to resume what he sees as its natural role, so that the Democrats have, in a sense, a healthy balancing force, and both parties ultimately will benefit.
You need a responsible conservative party in this country, for sure. I mean, I think the country's best off when the two parties work together, and large percentages of Americans claim that they want that. But increasingly, polarization means that our behavior, as well as office holders, is working really in the other direction. And so if you don't have two parties committed to some kind of, compromise, solution, problem-solving approach, then you need one party to just dominate the other as a way to, move forward, because our system of checks and balances and separated powers means that unless one party has so dominated the other, and the last time I can think of where this has really been the case is the 1930s in the Democratic Party. Unless you had that kind of situation, the other party out of power, so to speak, is capable of gumming up the works. Hmm.
Well, on that note, we finish things up, but we of course need to have more conversations as November approaches and as the landscape continues to change one way or another. And I appreciate, as always, the commentary that you are willing to offer us on an array of issues and concerns. Dr. Gerald Mass, Chair of the Political Science Department at Carthage, Professor of Political Science. Thanks for today's conversation.
It's been my pleasure, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm going to be speaking with Doug Instanis and Jocelyn Fish. They are from the Racine Theater Guild, and they're going to be taking us behind the scenes of the very difficult decision that the Theater Guild ultimately made in terms of reshaping the 2020-2021 season there. Essentially canceling the fall portion of the season and resuming performances, they hope, in January. We're going to be finding out about some of the conversations that took place, some of the factors that were weighed. It gives us some insight into the difficult choices that are being faced by performing arts organizations all across the state and indeed across the country. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu.